Welcome to the Veritas Forum.
This is the Veritas Forum podcast,
a place where ideas and beliefs converge.
What I'm really going to be watching is which one has the resources in their worldview to be tolerant, respectful, and humble toward the people they disagree with.
How do we know whether the lives that we're living are meaningful?
If energy, light, gravity, and consciousness are a mystery, don't be surprised if you're going to get an element of this in God.
Today we hear from Professor of Anthropology at the University of Tennessee at Chattanooga, Pamela Ashmore, with Associate Professor of Laboratory and Genomic Medicine at Washington University at St. Louis, Joshua Swamidas, in a discussion about human origins, evolution, and what's at stake, a talk titled Finding a Common Story, moderated by Michelle Deardorff at the University of Tennessee at Chattanooga.
I'm a biological anthropologist. So in other words, I'm a social scientist and someone who considers evolution as absolutely of paramount importance to how I frame, conduct, and review research, as well as how I understand the natural world in which we live. As mentioned, I did both of my master's and PhD work at Washington University in St. Louis, where Josh is a faculty member, and I find that kind of fun for the forum discussion tonight. For those of you who might not know, biological anthropology is actually a subfield of anthropology, and it focuses on humans as a biocultural species. In other words, we can't take the biology out of us, and we can't take the culture out of us. Biological anthropologists do study our evolution. They study human biological variation, as well as our closest living relatives, the non-human primates. And as mentioned in my career, I have focused on the latter part of this. So my research really involved looking at the adaptability of a big group of species called macaques. And they're incredibly diverse in the terms of behavior, ecology, and also physical appearances. Some of you may be more familiar with the macaques as Japanese snow monkeys or as the rhesus macaques that have been used extensively in biomedical research. I've also spent a great deal of time throughout my professional career really focused in on science education. So I would like to now tell three very short stories, and I think that they will illustrate a bit about who I am and what I do. When I was a faculty member at the University of Missouri in St. Louis, I was the co-director of a hands-on experiential learning program called the Center for Human Origin and Cultural Diversity. This program was originally geared for middle school students. So they would come to UMSL on a field trip basis and go through our lab-based program. We then revised the program to accommodate high school students, pre and in-service teachers, undergrads, grads, and even community groups. Over the course of like 6 years, we put over 12,000 individuals through this program, ranging in age from 8 to 86. One lab component focused on human evolution. And we discovered very quickly that the minute we use the word evolution, that teachers, or more regularly, adults that had accompanied students on this field trip, took issue with our use of the word or mention of the word evolution. This initiated conversations that took time, and they would actually derail the ability of students to complete the lab portion of the particular session that they were in. Consequently, as the co-director of this program, I banned the use of the word evolution. So I wouldn't allow the facilitators, who were typically graduate students and undergraduate students, to use the word evolution. Now, my professional colleagues greatly criticized me for making this decision, but it had positive results, because the students would be tasked with questions. They were working with a very robust collection of fossil cast material about human evolution. And by not mentioning evolution, it didn't sidetrack the progress of the students. They answered the questions. They actually then grasped various concepts about human evolution, and they were readily able to identify trends that had occurred over time. Second story. For a period of time, when I was living in St. Louis, I had a Darwin fish symbol on my car. When I left my car at the long-term airport parking lot, or even if I went into like a Walgreens or a grocery store or Walmart, I'd often return to my car and I would have little paper messages left on my windshield. And some of them I found quite astonishing. Some of them I actually very much appreciated because I would get messages from unknown individuals stating that they would pray for me. They would pray for my soul. Would I please give Jesus a chance? And then I would also get messages saying things like, you know, you basically are doomed to go to hell. So there was quite a range in the messages that I received. And it made me stop and wonder, why did people automatically assume, because I had a Darwin fish symbol on my car, that I was then an atheist? That's my second story. My third story involves Dr. Deardorff. In the spring of 2018, we team taught a class for the Honors College at UTC, along with a biology colleague and a religious studies colleague. The course was called From Dayton to Dover, focusing, of course, on evolution and creationism. As part of the course, we took the students on a field trip to the Creation Museum and the Ark Encounter in Kentucky. What we saw and what I heard parents explaining to their young children left me speechless. And along with my biology colleague, pretty disheartened about what we observed to be a complete lack of scientific literacy. So helping people to understand what evolution is and is not, how it relates to our prehistoric past and our future, and to appreciate scientific findings and research is very important to me. To end, I am going to use a term that was shared with me by a mentor and friend. I identify as a non-theist. I do have beliefs, but they don't necessarily align with a belief in the existence of some omniscient being. So I will end it there.
Thanks for sharing, Pam.
Sure.
I'm going to put up my slides here and tell a little more. My name is Josh Swamidas. I'm a professor. And yeah, I'm a professor at Washington University, where you were for a while. It's kind of funny how worlds cross like that. Science is a small world. I'm a Christian, too. I cringed at some of the notes that you were getting. I'm sorry that Christians haven't always been better to you. But the reason why I'm a Christian isn't because Christians act well all the time, but because I encountered something very real in who Jesus was. I was raised as an Earth creationist, and I also encountered something very real in what evolution is, unfortunately, for some people who are listening here. But that's okay. I'm not trying to convince you that it's true. I think people are threatened by evolution because they know already that it's a very strong idea. If it was really a myth, it would have been put to rest a long, long time ago, and there wouldn't be so many Christians that saw legitimacy to it. But I'm going to talk to you really about the end of my story, where I moved from really being fearful of engaging with evolutionary science, to not really knowing what to do with it, really having to find courage to engage with it, to really starting to make sense of everything together. And it really came down to understanding how the story I learned in scripture could actually be understood, is a better way to understand it, alongside the story I was learning in science class. So this is the story of Adam and Eve and human origins. And then this is the story we have of a progression of forms from common ancestors of the great apes to bring us. Now, some people really dismiss the importance of this by just saying, well, it's just in the past, who really cares what you think, or by dismissing one or the other side of it. I think the reality is that the reason why people care about this topic is because it does matter. It tells us something about who we are and where we came from. And so we do want to know about what happened. And I think getting some of the story right here is important. The problem is, how do we deal with it when we come with two totally different stories? Now, as I go forward, I think some of the people listening are going to think the left half of the story is a myth. That's okay. I'm not trying to convince you it's real right now. You can carry that as a myth and let's go forward. Now, other people here are going to really think that the right half of this slide is a myth. That's okay too. Don't worry about it. I'm not trying to convince you. I think what we're going to try and do and see is if there's a way we can imagine a reality. Maybe it's science fiction or theological fiction. You don't have to agree that it actually happened. But is there a way to imagine how both these could be true at the same time in the same physical reality? And that's really what this book is that I wrote. It's called The Genealogical Adam and Eve. I think the link should be there in the chat. And I found out that actually there isn't as much conflict as people had thought. In fact, maybe there's not any conflict at all. So let me explain to you a little bit more about what I mean. When I talk about Adam and Eve, I mean that they were created without parents less than 10,000 years ago, and they're ancestors of everyone. By evolution, you can drop the term, if you really don't like the term evolution, I could have just crossed that out and just talked about common ancestry with the great apes. This is an important point because there are Christians that will attack evolution by pointing to things like the Cambrian explosion and things like that, or intelligent design. That's all just arguing at the margins, because even Michael Behe, who's a guy who I've, you know, who's well known in intelligent design, a friend of mine, he actually agrees that the evidence for that we share common ancestors with the great apes is really, really strong. And that's all I'm really talking about here. And there's strong evidence for it. And that's where I think the theologically challenging piece is. And then two, that our species arises as a population, not a single couple. Now, most people on both sides of the conversation for the last 160 years thought that these two panels can't be right at the same time. That it's either this was true or this was true, and you have to modify something here or there, but really, they both couldn't be true at the same time. And what I found out actually is that because of some pretty fundamental misunderstandings that, in fact, they really could be true at the same time. In fact, Adam and Eve could be ancestors of everyone, created less than 10,000 years ago, ancestors of us all, and at the same time, we share common ancestors of the grapes and arise as a population, not as a single couple. So how does that work? Well, let me show you. Part of it has to do with how we read scripture, and I'm happy to take questions on this from you as students. I'm not going to get into the details here, but point out that the way how the story of Genesis is told is it talks about Adam and Eve, which you can imagine right here at the tip of this shape here, spreading out across the globe until it becomes everyone. And then, you know, in Acts and Romans, it really seems like it's teaching that we all descend from Adam and Eve. But the important thing is that there's a question mark if you look at the Genesis tradition. Whenever people read Genesis, they were always uncertain and unclear if what was outside the garden, and they wondered if there were people out there. Now, one way to understand this, the way I was taught to understand it, not from scripture, but by people, was that the question mark should be just filled in with emptiness, that there's nothing out there. Now, that's one way to read the story, but it's certainly not the only way. The other way to read it, which I left out, is that maybe there is people outside. And those people came into the world by an evolutionary process, that God created them by a process of common descent. So it's still creation, but it's by a different process. And they interbred with Adam and Eve's lineage. So in that way, we descend from both Adam and Eve and the people outside the garden. So in that way, Genesis will be really telling us the story of Adam and Eve and how they fell and how everyone else really joined into that lineage. You see them in the peripheral vision in a couple places of Genesis. And science is just telling us the story of the people outside the garden. There's some really good scientific reasons why we don't expect to see Adam and Eve in the genetic evidence. We just don't see them. So they're invisible, not because God intended it that way, but just because, or because he's hiding them, but just he didn't, that the evidence just got erased over time. And so then the same physical reality, maybe there really was Adam and Eve specially created as recently as even just 6,000 years ago, or maybe more ancient. And then when they fell, the rest of the people God had created fell into their lineage too. And then with the rise of civilization, that's really how we got to be who we are. And that's where we came from. Really both these two lineages, both these two stories at the same time. So that's a crazy idea. There's a lot of questions you might have about that. And it's been fun talking to theologians and scientists about it. One of the really interesting things about this that might surprise you is that my book, when it was published, it was actually endorsed by atheist scientists. and secular scientists. Pam, you know Alan Templeton, right?
Yes.
He's like a serious scientist, right?
Yes, he is.
He endorsed my book. And this was really surprising for a lot of Christians. I think the reason why is that they've been taught, or I've been taught, that scientists are really anti-religious. They're anti-Christian. Now, it's true, many scientists don't believe in God. I do. I found Jesus. And, you know, who knows? Maybe Pam will someday, too. But here's the thing. Even if you don't believe God is real, it doesn't mean you're anti-religious. And it turns out that most scientists have really high integrity. When Alan Templeton read my book, also Nathan Lentz is an atheist biologist too who read the book, he looked at it and he saw that it was totally unassailable, that it was good science that was going to help make science that they really cared about better understood in parts of the church that they had a hard time reaching. And so they endorsed it because they saw it was good science doing good. And so we found a common story. Now, of course, when they read it, they see Adam and Eve as a myth. And maybe as you read this, you're thinking evolution's a myth. But, you know, we can still enter the same stories and disagree about which parts are myths, right? So that's what I wanted to share with you. That's how I've been exploring how to find a common story together.
As I'm listening to both of you, one of the things I thought about is that, and, you know, I teach a lot of I teach political theory and law. And when we talk about myths, it doesn't necessarily mean falsehood. It means a founding story, right? On which things are, on which understandings and worldviews are based. So the question I have is the importance of these founding stories talking to each other. So outside of the scientist of faith or the person of faith who's interested in the findings of science, are there reasons that science and its practitioners should be concerned about discussions of human origins that are happening in faith communities? Josh, you referenced the impact that religious interpretation or mystery, as you call it in your book, could have on scientific inquiry. And Pam, I think you're a little less confident of religious interpretation's impact on science. So is this a bigger issue, and I don't mean to diminish this, than an effort to bring fragmented faith communities together or helping believers who feel torn between the demands of their faith communities and their beliefs in the scientific method? In other words, should science and faith be in communication with one another, or are they just merely different ways of knowing?
Josh, do you want to start or do you want me to start?
Maybe we'll go back and forth a little bit. I'll just say briefly, there's a lot of reasons why if you're not a Christian, you should care about how faith communities talk about human origins. I think the fundamental problem we face right now as scientists is building trust with the public. We spend a great deal of time learning and understanding how the world works, but it doesn't really matter if we're right if we're not trusted. And if you want to build trust with parts of the community that don't trust us, you have to listen and learn and pay attention. I think that's like probably one of the most important reasons why it's important to care about that. But beyond that, you know, even if you're not a Christian, even if you're not religious, there is a grand conversation about what it means to be human that's been going on for thousands of years. And it includes philosophers, it includes theologians, it includes these myths from different cultures, not just Christian, but also other cultures. And for goodness sakes, why wouldn't you want to be part of that grand conversation and bringing science into dialogue with that? It seems like there's something really broken if we're not interested in participating. Participating in that conversation. And you don't have to be a Christian to want to do that. I mean, give me a break. That's what we should be doing.
Well, and unfortunately, I think scientists have had a tradition of, we don't want to go there. You know, we don't want to talk to creationists because we know more. And scientists have also done a pretty poor job, I think. I think we're getting better at communicating and being able to talk and explain the research that we do to the general public. I think we have either intentionally or unintentionally made a lot of the information about human evolution unavailable to the general public. I think one of the concerns that I have about the question, Michelle, that you asked about basically, are there reasons to be concerned about discussions about human origins that are happening in faith communities is I get concerned when I think that faith community just closes down and doesn't want to hear anything. And Josh, you basically talked about that in your introduction. I think that that becomes very problematic. I've seen that with my own students. I teach biological anthropology every fall. We go through evolution, we cover human evolution. And I have students who will come to me and say, I was brought up as a Christian fundamentalist. I am a creationist. And right now I'm sitting on the fence and I don't know what to do. And as much as that's a struggle for the student, I think that's a good thing, because I think then they're considering different ways of knowing about the world in which we live. I do get concerned when people jump to conclusions about what they think evolution is. You know, we have all heard people say, you can't tell me I evolved from a chimpanzee. And of course, my pat answer is, of course, I would never say that. No evolutionist would ever say that. But that, I think, is a good illustration of the misconceptions and the misunderstandings that people have about evolution in general.
Yeah, I think this gets to the issue. I think what the core of the problem is trust. They think that, or that we were taught, I was taught, and people are still taught, that evolution is just a lie that's designed to replace like the truth. And all of those, you know, evolutionists out there are out to get you. And, you know, it's just not actually true. I mean, I think there are some anti-religious scientists out there.
Yeah.
That are trying to use evolution as a wedge, but the big fly in the ointment for them, like the big difficult thing for them to explain, is all the Christians like me that are, I'm not even like a liberal Christian. I mean, I'm from the Lausanne Covenant. I'm fairly conservative in my beliefs, and there just isn't actually a conflict when you understand the two. I think there's a couple things going on for students that I had to work through. And if you're struggling through this conversation too, there's two things that really helped me. One was understanding what the foundation for a confident faith in science could be. And what I learned from Young Earth Creationism is that the foundation of a confident faith was creation science. And I just want to tell you that you can try to put your foundation there. You're just going to feel very, very insecure because it's not a very strong foundation. Would you agree with me on that, Dan? Yeah. I think if there's any reason to be a Christian, it's because of what God did to reveal himself through history by raising Jesus from the dead. I mean, that's how I know that God exists. He's good and wants to be known. That's the only reason why I care about Genesis in the first place. Now, Pam will disagree with me on that, and that's okay. But what I do know is that there's really nothing in evolution, whether it's true or false, that really threatens Jesus. I'm not really concerned if that's where my foundation is. That's the first thing. The second thing that I would really want to point to is Proverbs 4:6. It says, you know, first seek understanding. You know, you probably don't know what evolution is if you're fearful of it. And you may not even know what Genesis says. You might just know more what people have told you Genesis says. So what has helped me more than anything else is to actually look and understand. Now, you don't have to agree with something to understand it. I started to understand evolution long before I agreed with it. And I also found out as I looked at Genesis more closely is that it didn't say what many of the adults around me told me it said. It just didn't have those words in it. Those were interpretations. They were trying to assert man's word into God's word. And I found out that actually the problem isn't with God's word, even if you read it really literally. The problem is really with people who are men trying to, or maybe women sometimes, but men often, trying to pass their word off, their interpretation off as God's word. And that's actually not just a problem with science. That's a problem in our faith. And when I start to see that, because I understood scripture for myself, well, you know, that really started to release a lot of the pressure and make the whole situation far more comfortable.
Well, good points. And certainly the students I've had have always been very grateful that in the classes that I've had with them, that we have open conversations. And often they talk about being in a different science-based class where even the mention of their beliefs causes the professor who's teaching the class to kind of be dismissive. And I don't think that's appropriate. I think one of the other things that's important is that people don't necessarily understand the basic nature of science, that it is self-correcting. I often tell students, look, I accept the evidence for evolution and the evolution of humans. Do I believe in evolution? I'm very careful when I address a question about that because I don't consider it a belief. I consider it that I accept the data that has accumulated to support the theory of evolution, which of course means that it's a unifying explanation for lots of facts that we have observed over time. But one of the things that I think is really interesting is that people, you know, I will then say, so let me finish my first thought. I will tell students, look, we could have aliens. We could have an alien invasion tomorrow. Aliens could land on Earth and declare that human beings were a grand experiment. What would I have to do? Well, I would have to incorporate this new data into my understanding. And if that meant that I had to throw much of my understanding of evolution out the window, that is what I would need to do. And I think people don't understand the self-correcting nature of science. If something is not falsifiable, it doesn't lend itself to scientific inquiry. So in having this discussion, and Michelle alluded to this, they are very different ways of knowing. I think they can interdigitate. They certainly, as Stephen Jay Gould said, they bump up against each other constantly. And I think that we have to be open to explore the way that we have different viewpoints and how you might be able to put them together. I think if you are if you interpret the Bible literally, that is certainly more of a challenge for you than if you are like a theistic evolutionist. It's easier then to put the realms together.
Well, my book actually shows how a literal interpretation of Genesis can actually be consistent with evolution.
Right, I know.
So I think that was a really hard point, but maybe not so much anymore, which I think is exciting. Right. I think those are really good thoughts, Pam, though. I mean, I appreciate you for sharing it.
Yeah, and you do refer to it throughout your text, and I appreciate it as a thought experiment and as speculative narrative. And I think it's a fascinating story. Certainly I can't, and I've told you this, I can't get into the details of your genealogical modeling. I really can't. I get kind of lost as I'm reading through it, and I kind of went through the book again before this forum.
Well, that's very kind of you. Thanks.
So, I mean, there are things, Josh, that when I read your book, I find it difficult to incorporate it into kind of scientific and queer inquiry as I know it to be.
Yeah. So clearly, when we talk about, for example, the de novo creation of Adam and Eve, that's something that will be very hard to make sense of in science alone.
Right. We can't.
And so I talk about how that actually we don't expect to see any evidence. And so I think, especially for scientists that haven't had a lot of depth in like philosophy of science, but I mean, frankly, it's just a very different way of thinking. Mm-hmm. It really comes down to whether or not we trust scripture and what we think it says. And I think that that's okay, because I'm not actually trying to say that every single fact can be found by science, but I don't think you think that either. Like, for example, I'm pretty sure, Pam, that you think that racism is wrong. But what's the experiment that tells us that racism is morally wrong? I don't think that there is one. And I think that's a pretty important thing to know. So I would suggest that you probably know that, and you know that by means other than science. And that's okay. And I just think that that's kind of how it works. Like, science gives us insight into the world, but it's kind of one of the blind men holding the elephant. There's other ways to take hold of reality too that are important. And the only way we can really understand what we're dealing with is if we start to try and understand science alongside other things. Does that sound like a crazy possibility, or what do you think?
No, it doesn't sound like a crazy possibility. I think the conversation is a fascinating one. I just think that they are very different ways of knowing. And I don't expect that either one would necessarily replace the other. I don't think you
agree with you there
either. You know, But when we're talking about, so to go back to your mention of racism, I think there's been quite a few studies done where we have tested to see if racism plays a role in how people are treated. And yes, it has. So something like that does lend itself to scientific investigation. The de novo creation of Adam and Eve does not. I can't
What's interesting though, what's interesting about this though, Pam, is until my book came out, for 160 years, people thought that evolution meant that Adam and Eve weren't de novo created. So that's a pretty substantial change to have you, a scientist, saying, well, I guess we don't know from science. Do you see that shift? Isn't that kind of cool?
Yeah, that is a shift. I will accept what I don't know. I mean, I certainly will accept that there are things that I can't, that I just don't know. And I think that that's where faith allows people to know things in a certain way that I think is hugely valuable.
So it's worth talking about what faith is. I mean, we're probably derailing our poor moderator here, but we have scientists, when we talk about faith and how you were talking about belief, they tend to think it means like evidence-free. But that's not actually what I think Christians, or at least it's not what I mean by it as a Christian. And it is different than science, but maybe not as different as maybe you would think. Think about it. Like most of the important studies and observations of your field, you didn't actually observe directly. You heard them through faithful reports from trustworthy people. Mm-hmm. And what happened is that you trusted those people. And to be clear, there was very good reason to trust them. And it's not just about them individually. I mean, they might have been horrible, dishonest people in their personal lives, but we're in a scientific community that's self-corrective, right? And so that the reports of scientists are, generally speaking, very trustworthy, right? And so, but we can't actually go and directly verify every single thing for ourselves. And so a key component of a faith is really just, is like a trust-like faith like that, where it's really wondering if that's a trustworthy source, for based on evidence even, and then trying to take that account, because there's certain things you can only know if people will tell you. I don't know if you're married or not, or what your personal, you are. Yeah, so like, you know, there's certain things that I would have never gotten married to my wife, Victoria, unless I heard certain things from her that I could have never found out any other way than from talking to her. She'd have to tell me that she loved me, right? And I can't get that secondhand. There's no way to do an experiment, at least don't try to do an experiment on the person you're thinking about to find that out. You just actually have to hear it. And I think that there's a lot of knowledge, maybe even the majority of human knowledge, comes when a trustworthy person tells us something.
I'm going to jump in here.
Oh, go ahead, Michelle. I'm sorry.
In a slightly different direction. Pam, keep your point so you can jump back in with it.
And you're fun talking to, Pam. I feel like we could go all night.
I want to get back to that issue of trust in science. Go ahead, Michelle. I'm sorry.
Maybe you can morph this back to that.
I'll try.
Good. Okay. So I know both of you believe that the way we understand human origins has significant import for the question of how we understand and discuss both race and kind of the demand for racial equality in the 21st century. What is that relevance to our understanding of race, and how should this interpretation impact our efforts as we move forward? And maybe this does get to the idea of where those lines are with, or lack of lines between faith and science. So Pam, do you want to start this time?
Sure, I can. Right now I'm teaching a course in human variation. It's a course I've taught many times. And one of the things that I've seen, and even when I was working with that program in St. Louis, not that science is going to solve our problems, but when people understand the science behind human variation based on this concept of race, I think it allows for a more level playing field, shared knowledge that we can then construct and look at how culture has framed the reality of human races. Biologically, we can't do it, but culturally, we certainly do it all of the time. And I think this is where science and thinking about human origins and looking at kind of our shared ancestry, looking at the findings from the Human Genome Project, we can see that we are a united species and that we can't divide up the humanity as it exists into different racial biological groups. And I think that that's so important. We had a student, we were working with Florissant Middle School, which is right next to Ferguson, okay, to give you kind of an inkling as to where we are. And we had a young African-American student who was a middle schooler. And we went through this experiential lesson on the adaptive significance of light and dark skin color variation. And at the end of it, he looked up and he said, you know, the next time somebody calls me and he used the N-word on the playground, I'm going to look at them and I'm going to say, you know, jack about the science. We were like, whoa, you know, this is like, this was a middle schooler. Now, when I would have adults go through this experiential learning lab on the adaptive significance of light and dark skin color, the adults had a very difficult time with it. And that's because of lived experiences. We have grown up thinking that because of different skin colors, that means that they're different kinds of people. You know, kind of this whole biological keratinism idea. And you certainly talk about that, Josh, as well in your book. So I think that in this case, having that common understanding that there is no concordance between different like continental races of people and biological or genetic characteristics, there'd have to be concordance in order for us to say that biologically there are different races of human beings. I think that that understanding, that initial understanding of the science allows us to then construct much more meaningful conversations about how to address social inequalities that are based on these constructs having to do with different kinds of people.
So in the interest of time, I'll be brief, but I think one thing, well, first of all, I agree with everything you said, Pam. I think it's very important for us to understand that race is an origins myth. Mm-hmm. You know, as I was writing my book, I went back and studied the history in science and in theology over the last 500 years, and you find out that actually race is a fairly recent idea.
Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm. And it has a false theory of origins. And the way how race was understood for most of the last 500 years is not really how even racists tend to think about it today. We tend to have like an idea that there's like a weak biological connection. Now, some people think it's stronger than others, but it's generally weak. But if you go to just like, you know, maybe 50, 60 years ago, and the majority of scientists thought it was a strong biological determinism. And that arose not out of scientific study, but very strong presuppositions that arose like with colonialism and like the discovery of the New World. And it's really important to realize that there was racism in theology and in the church with Christians. And there was people trying to justify it with scripture, with the story of Ham's curse, Cain's curse, all of this sort of stuff there. And Noah, like the term we get for Caucasian arises from the Caucasoid Mountains, where people thought Noah's Ark had landed and they thought that Caucasians descended from Noah and everyone else didn't. Mm-hmm. So it arose in the church, but it also arose in science.
Oh, yeah.
So you'll see, scientific racism was horrific, like genuinely horrific.
My discipline, especially.
Yeah, frankly, anthropology is ensconced in racism.
Yes.
And it's very recent, too. And we're not talking about stuff that's the ancient history. And so, you know, I think what's so remarkable to me as I started looking at this history is finding out how little I'd heard about it. The only times I'd heard racism talked about was from creationists complaining that evolution was racist and from scientists complaining that creationists were racist. And, you know, that's pretty appalling when you get right down to it. The fact of the matter is that, you know, if racism is a sin, we're all sinners. And I think that there's this reality that, you know, we try to forget those difficult things about the past, but if we don't remember them, we're really missing out on a reality of what's got things to be the way they are now. And it'll be very hard to understand how to undo it.
So we're going to move now to the audience questions that have been submitted through Slido. Sorry. Time is going fast.
Wow.
So here's one. In our post-logic, polarized, politicized culture, what are some of the ways to engage doubters, both the doubters of science and the doubters of religion?
Well, have fun conversations where you try to understand one another and trying to be understood. Like, you know, it's funny. I think the way how most people try to engage people to disagree is by trying to persuade. But there's something profoundly counterintuitive about persuasion. If someone feels like you're trying to persuade them, you're very unlikely to persuade them. And if you really want to persuade them, you're going to try to. So, but it ends up actually undermining your ability to do it. However, if you actually genuinely enter a conversation, just trying to pursue understanding, like Proverbs talks about, and just say, I want to understand you. I want to understand why and what you believe and how. And I want you to understand me. And I'm not trying to convince you. I just want to understand. It turns out that that disarms people. It gets them out of the fight and flight response. And ironically, it makes it more likely that people are going to be persuaded. And so it's just not what we do when we're trying to persuade people. So that's like the weird, the catch 22. I think that we should just try to engage one another to understand one another. And I think we'll find that we have far more common ground than we thought. And I think that is really honestly the way forward in a divided world. What do you think, Pam?
No, I would agree with you, Josh. And I think this forum is a good example. People want to be heard. So the first step is you have to listen. Okay. You have to acknowledge somebody's point of view. You might not agree with it. I don't agree with some of the things that Josh is saying. He doesn't agree with some of the things that I'm saying. That's perfectly fine. You know, we can still have a really fascinating conversation, which I hope I'm not enjoying this much more than anybody else, I hope, because I'm having fun with this. I'm learning from Josh. I think it's so important that we have these open conversations and respect that people have different points of view. I get concerned when people aren't willing to listen. And I've had that experience too, you know, dealing with some very, very creationist individuals who just don't want to hear, they don't want to know, and they don't open themselves up to the conversation.
Yeah, and I deal with people like this quite a bit, for better or for worse. As I become more public about my faith and where I stand on evolution, I get a lot of unlistening people from both sides. But in the end, I think whether we like it or not, we're going to have to live in the same society. I mean, we're connected to each other because of that, whether we want it or not. So in the end, you know, I actually have a lot more hope for your generation, to be honest. Most of the people I'm difficult with are older than me, are difficult to deal with, are older than me. And it's not because I'm the young one. It's just because they're very different. They have different priorities, I would say, than my generation or probably your generation. I think that there's an opportunity for you guys to choose a better way. And, you know, whether or not those older generations come along, I don't know if it's as important about what type of world you guys want to claim. Do you want to claim a world where we can actually be, where we could be in a common society together, pursuing common goods, even though we disagree on important things? Or do you want more of the same? And I just have found very few, if any, people your age that want more of the same. So I have some hope.
There's been interesting studies done about myths. And that if you have a myth in your head, it's actually harder to dissuade a person from believing in that myth than it is a fact. So I think the older generations, you know, I often think of my father who passed away at 93. There was no way under the sun. I mean, he was a very intelligent man. There was no way on earth he would ever agree to the statement that biological races don't exist, because he had lived a life being told that they did. So I think that that's, you know, to your point, Josh, what I see with the kids that Michelle teaches and I teach and that you interact with, they tend
to... Young adults.
Yeah, they tend to be more open.
Yeah.
So there's a number of questions that are specifically asking Josh questions about his understanding. And so we're going to try to keep to the questions that engage both of our speakers that they can have conversation with each other. But I would encourage you to read Josh's book.
Well, we can take, I can answer some of them quickly, right? Or no?
Well, I mean, they're very specific. And so, but there are questions you directly answer in great detail in the text. But I want to go with a larger question. And then if we have time, we can go after the specific questions asked to either one of you. It was mentioned that a fundamental problem right now is the public distrust of science. What can help?
Well, we're seeing that right now with vaccinations. And Josh, you mentioned that earlier on in our conversation. Again, I think communication, I think people being willing to listen. Certainly our current situation with the COVID vaccinations, we can go back to how historically in this country, African Americans, Native Americans have been mistreated by biomedical researchers. And there's a history of mistrust that has been built over generations. So I think just having to be very open and somewhat persistent about trying to communicate. You know, like Josh said, you can't debate, you can't oppose somebody. You that's not the way to persuade somebody.
So I think one thing, well, first of all, I'll tell you, I mean, I'm a scientist and I think that I'm speaking as a scientist when I say this. And if you're a scientist here or if you're planning to be one, I think what I'm going to say is important because I'm speaking to you. I think we have not done a good job as scientists engaging the public. Someone else asked a question about, you know, when Richard Dawkins actually does stuff, does that actually hurt? Yeah, absolutely it does. In fact, most scientists think that he's not the greatest representative of evolution to the public because of that. But very few of us reward or risk or take the time and pay the cost of actually engaging the public. And I think that that's a mistake on a lot of levels. I think that, if you're gonna be a scientist, you're gonna be relying on public funds. I think we need to start seeing ourselves as servants of the public and realizing that part of our job when we kind of take this profession on as a calling, as a vocation, where we're going to be competing for government funds to fund our research. I think we need to start acting as if it's true. It's like our job is to be ambassadors to the public, not advocating for our personal beliefs, but really trying to serve the public. I think that ethic has been lost. The other thing too, that I think scientists have forgotten about is that there's actually a great deal of science on the right ways to engage the public. And the general mistake that scientists make is they take an information deficit or knowledge deficit approach where they try and come as an expert telling everyone how it works, but that just actually undermines trust. What we've seen over and over again in study after study is that a trust-based approach works better. And trust grows in dialogue where we are able to humbly enter conversations and hear what other people have found in the world and talk to them and engage with them, answer questions, take those questions seriously, and also tell them about what we're seeing in the world too. And that's what the evidence just really shows. And so if we care about advancing science, and if we take that up forward as one of the things we care about, we will be doing it more often and we'll be doing it better.
Okay, Josh, here's a question specifically about one of the arguments in your book. And then we've got another question after that's kind of a bigger question again, that would apply for both of you. In your understanding, would the evolutionary derived humans be considered created in the image of God? And I know you spend chapters on this.
Yeah, so it's interesting. I get that question all the time, but one of the things that's most interesting about that question is that everyone really seems to care about the image of God. I'll tell you, even atheists do because of Martin Luther King, right? So, and also these kind of it's in the cultural water that we're all swimming in. But most people don't even know what the image of God actually is. So we know it's important, but what is it? And then we don't know. But then here's the thing that really surprised me. I started talking to theologians and I found out that they couldn't agree with one another on what the image of God is. And so this is something that's fairly important as we kind of enter that conversation. Like I said, I wrote a lot, quite a bit about it as kind of like a, kind of Alice going down the rabbit hole with the theologians trying to make sense of it. But I think that depending on how you understand what the image of God is, how you read the relationship between Genesis 1 and Genesis 2, maybe those people outside the garden that God created another way were in the image of God. I think that's what makes most sense to me. Now, some people will disagree with that, but I don't think it's necessarily a problem if they weren't either, as long as we agree that they were, fully human and had human worth and dignity. And as long as that's there, I just don't see what the problem would be. But I think what makes the most sense to me is that they were in the image of God.
I think this is an interesting question, because I remember when we taught this, and the question is, how would each of you go about disproving your own beliefs? And one of the things I remember, Pam, when we taught this course, is when we were talking about the nature of research and science, that when you publish and you write, you do it with the understanding that at some point people will find you wrong. Mm-hmm. And if you've done a good job really thinking this through, you want that, because it shows your ideas are being engaged and considered, and how shocked our students were at that concept of putting work out there with the hope that people will challenge it and disagree with you and find better ways of doing it. So could you talk about this idea of how in the way you both process the world, you're anticipating and thinking about how would you disprove your own beliefs?
Wow. Well, yikes. I don't really know how to address that other than having the alien invasion happening. I honestly don't know. I think what you started with, Michelle, was the self-correcting nature of science. I mean, I have faith in that as more evidence amounts, we can use that data, we can use that evidence to fine-tune conclusions that we've come to. So I think there would have to be evidence. I'd have to see data. We'd have to see probably something supernatural in a respect for me to say that I could not then accept evolution.
But I mean, evolution is probably true. I think the more likely place that you might... Well, look, I didn't know about it until I looked, but there's actually evidence about the resurrection. I'd be really curious to see how that actually adjusted how you saw the world. I mean, I'm not going to put you in the spot here.
Thank you.
But honestly, that's actually where I think there's more likely, because there is actually a lot of evidence, and most scientists don't know about it. But that's beside that point. For me, I did change my views. I was raised a young earth creationist, and I really believed it. And then I was really drawn to, intelligent design, and I really believed it. And I think there's this aspect that I came to deeply appreciate about scientists. I think that we're taught to voluntarily give ground when we're wrong. Mm-hmm. Not to do it when we're forced to, but to just voluntarily give ground. And I noticed that that wasn't happening among creationists, and it wasn't happening among ideists. They didn't usually acknowledge when they had something wrong. And even when it was really clear, they would just keep on saying it. And that was really befuddling for me. But then when I saw scientists, the scientists in mainstream science, I just saw this different pattern. And I came to very deeply respect that. And really, even before I was like fully trained as a scientist, really think through carefully what that meant. You know, when it came to my book, I made mistakes in my book. There's actually some scientific errors in it. And I actually knew I was going to make mistakes in it, because everyone makes mistakes when you do something that's difficult. And so I actually started and planned to actually have an error correction policy for the book and to have an erratum. And I committed to publicly correcting the errors I made. So if you go to my website, peacefulscience.org, you'll see a few articles there and a very long erratum. It's about 5 pages long, very, very small print. Most of it's typos, but some of it is actually substantive scientific issues that I got wrong. And I wanted to be in that place where I was thanking the people who corrected me. Like I said, voluntarily giving wrong. I mean, giving ground to the people when I was wrong. And I think that's the best of science. And it's, of course, deeply consistent with my Christian faith. I have nothing to cling to. I'm not defending anything. I encountered something that's greater than myself. And, And I follow Jesus because he's greater than anything I found in science. I don't have to defend him. And so it just kind of gives me like this freedom, even when it comes to matters of quote unquote faith. I don't have to take that defensive posture, that kind of like, you know, I'm not willing to. I can take that more open-handed thing of like, you know, this is what I've seen and this is what makes sense. And maybe I'm wrong on some details or even some big things. Let's actually sort it out together.
There's a question, Pam, directly towards you. You mentioned the Human Genome Project. When you consider Francis Collins and his theistic perspective, is theism puzzling to you as a, with him being a major scientist? Does that surprise you to see prominent scientists who profess faith?
No, not at all. No, because I think that there are ways to put faith and science together. And theistic evolutionists do that, and he is one. So that doesn't surprise me. I actually applaud their ability to find some degree of common ground. So no, I'm not surprised by that. I think I'm more surprised by people who are at the opposite ends of the spectrum. And there's a very large spectrum. That's the other thing I don't think people realize. You're not just a creationist or an evolutionist. And I don't think, Josh, you have given that impression at all. There's a whole continuum of positions that one can take between either of those ends of the spectrum.
And then, Josh, there's another question. Someone would like to hear your thoughts on the greater meaning of the creation story. For instance, sin bringing death into the world versus death bringing sin, those kinds of larger questions.
Oh, yeah. I mean, you'll find that I have, you know, very orthodox view of that. That's probably closer to a literal reading than most young earth and creationists readings. So when I read Genesis, it's very clear. It's not really spending much time talking about the people outside the garden. So it's talking about Adam and Eve and their descendants. They're in the garden, Adam and Eve, free of death, free physical death I'm talking about. And then in the fall, they're expelled from the garden. They don't have access to the tree of life. So then death comes to their world. And if they hadn't sinned, we would all still be in the garden. We wouldn't be facing death. And so it's literally what Romans says, Romans 5, 12 through 14, that death came into Adam's world because he sinned. And so I don't actually, I mean, there doesn't seem to be any conflict there. Now, the question now becomes, well, what about death outside the garden then? But actually, if you look at Genesis 3, it's very clear that the way how death comes to Adam and Eve is because they're expelled from the garden. The garden had clear borders. He says that they actually put an angel there to prevent them from entering back in. So I just say the clear literal teaching of Genesis is that the garden is in a narrow space. And that Adam and Eve, if they're not in the garden, they're not going to be immortal. They're only immortal if they're in the garden with access to the tree of life. And then, and that means that there was death outside the garden. That's what Genesis teaches.
So we've titled this discussion, Human Origins, Evolution, and What's at Stake. We know that this question can be a very difficult one and often a visceral one for those both in science and in faith communities. So I guess I'd like to hear you both talk about what exactly is at stake for both communities that have made it so hard for us to come to common ground.
Well, in one sense, I'd say that there's a lot less at stake than we thought. So I don't think, you know, if you think a literal reading of Genesis is important, that's not at stake here. You know, if you think that, you know, being a faithful Christian is at stake here, that's just not true. You can be a faithful follower of Jesus here. That's not what's at stake. If you, you know, those are just not the things that are at stake. What I think is at stake is that, you know, I think God spoke to us through scripture, but he also spoke to us through nature too. And I think we're missing out on a really grand and beautiful story if we don't just chill out and take the time to learn. You know, the reason why scientists study evolution isn't because of creationists. Most of them don't engage with creationists at all. The reason why they study all this stuff is because it's freaking amazing. It is a really grand story that God's telling us in nature. I mean, of course, you know, there's other things that you can't get from nature that he's telling us too. So, I mean, I still think the story, I mean, what God did through Jesus is greater than science, but let's not be silly here. What we see in science is pretty amazing. And you're missing out on that. And I think, you know, you can be in this fearful, you know, curled up position that's very defensive or at best or aggressive at worst. But that doesn't sound like fun. And frankly, people don't come to Jesus because they found out evolution is wrong. They come to Jesus because they found out that he's good. And, you know, in the end, you know, there's just a better opportunity. I think that's what's really at stake. We have an opportunity for a better sort of conversation, a better sort of church, a better sort of voice in science, and friendships with wonderful atheists in science, non-theists, I'm sorry, in science. Like Pam, I mean, like, you don't want to miss out on that. She's a great person.
What's at stake? That's a huge question, as we all recognize. I think for science, if we lose science, we have a lot at stake. I think we have the future of humanity, the future of our planet is at stake. So science is certainly going to be important. It's important now, it's important down the road. I think that scientists do miss out if they dismiss the importance of faith in a person's life. So if you are a faith-based person, then I think that provides some solace, that provides you with some degree of comfort and strength. So I think scientists have to respect that. And I think many scientists do. I don't think all scientists think that if somebody is faith-based, they're worth, you know, they're less than. So I think it's really important, again, that we be open to these communications and have these kinds of conversations.
Any last thoughts? Are there points you wanted to make you didn't get the chance to, or ideas you wanted to raise that you didn't get the chance to wrestle with?
Well, it seems like a lot of people are asking questions about the genealogical Adam and Eve. I think that's great. I love your questions. You know, if you want me to come back informally sometimes to talk to a smaller group of people who've read the book, I'm willing to. But I think the right place to start is by actually catching up on some of the stuff there. I think you'll have fun with it. You don't have to agree with evolution to read that book. And I think that could be a good starting point. And I think what you'll find that's interesting about it is that it'll show you, even if you're not sure about this evolution thing, you'll see that it doesn't actually have to be something that's necessary to oppose. And it might give you a common ground place to actually talk to people who really do agree with evolution. And maybe you're doubtful about the other side of it, and that's okay too. So that's there. You know, I mean, I really love dealing with students. And so it's a privilege to be here to talk to you about this. And it's honestly, Pam, it's been wonderful talking to you and getting to know you. We got a chance to talk a little bit beforehand and all. I think you're really lucky to have faculty like her here who are really wanting to respect your beliefs. You know, she's not trying to turn you on to atheists. That's one thing that really stuck out to me when I talked to her. She's trying to be a good host in science. And that's a really incredible privilege. So I hope you get a chance to follow up with her as well too. And especially when, you know, we're done with all the COVID restrictions and all. And just recognize that there's something really amazing about the university. It exposes us to ideas that we wouldn't have experienced otherwise, certain types of people. And you don't want to miss out on that. I think the biggest thing to lose is missing out on a lot of good things.
If you like this and you want to hear more, like, share, review, and subscribe to this podcast. And from all of us here at the Veritas Forum, thank you.